Welcome to the Legg Mason second fiscal quarter 2016 earnings call. My name is John, and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A brief question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the teleconference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this teleconference is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce your host, Alan Magleby, Head of Investor Relations and Corporate Communications. Thank you, Mr. Magleby. You may begin.
Thank you. On behalf of Legg Mason, I would like to welcome you to our conference call to discuss operating results for the fiscal 2016 second quarter ended September 30th, 2015. This presentation may contain forward-looking statements within the meaning of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. These forward-looking statements are not statements of facts or guarantees of future performance and are subject to risks, uncertainties, and other factors that may cause actual results to differ materially from those discussed in the statements. For a discussion of these risks and uncertainties, please see risk factors and management discussion and analysis of financial condition and results of operations in the company's annual report on Form 10-K for the fiscal year ended March 31st, 2015, and in the company's subsequent filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. During the call today, we may also discuss non-GAAP financial measures. Reconciliations of the non-GAAP financial measures to the comparable GAAP financial measures can be found in the press release that we issued this morning, which is available in the Investor Relations section of our website. The company undertakes no obligation to update the information contained in this presentation to reflect subsequently occurring events or circumstances. This morning's call will include remarks from Mr. Joe Sullivan, Legg Mason's Chairman and CEO, and Mr. Pete Nakwe, Legg Mason's CFO, who will discuss our financial results. In addition, following a review of the company's quarter, we will then open the call to Q&A. Now I would like to turn this call over to Mr. Joe Sullivan. Joe?
Thank you, Alan. And as always, I appreciate your time and joining us on the call today. Markets around the world experienced a significant return to volatility during the quarter, and that certainly affected our clients, Legg Mason, and our industry as a whole. Changes in how investors are thinking about equity valuations, uncertainty around the timing and impact of interest rate increases, volatility in oil and commodities, and concerns about the overall global macroeconomic environment all serve to create a higher degree of uneasiness, particularly with retail investors. The result of these forces was a dramatic increase in active mutual fund outflows in the U.S., totaling $103 billion, while internationally, long-term cross-border fund inflows reversed by nearly $100 billion to outflows of just over $50 billion during the quarter. Yet, against this market backdrop, the increasingly diversified nature of our business was validated. Specifically, I'm pleased to report our sixth consecutive quarter of organic growth with positive long-term net flows of $3.1 billion and an organic growth rate of 2.2%. Now, as Pete will explain, we also experienced some non-operating factors that adversely impacted our financials, but I am pleased with our quarterly operating performance and continued strategic progress. Positive long-term inflows were driven largely by fixed income, though we recorded modest inflows in equities as well. Brandywine Global, QS Investors, and Western Asset all had positive long-term flows for the quarter, while Martin Currie was break-even. While gross and net sales in global distribution were down quarter over quarter, gross sales in our global retail platform year to date are actually ahead of last year. Our global retail net sales numbers, while positive, are a bit behind year over year. Operating earnings and operating margins, as adjusted, were healthy, and our pipeline of unfunded wins remained strong at $9.4 billion at quarter's end. Most importantly for the long run, however, we continue to diversify our affiliate mix with an expanded set of investment capabilities that, as recent markets demonstrate, are critical for our clients as they navigate market turbulence. As you know, investor needs and preferences continue to evolve. Increasingly, investment strategies that are more flexible and outcome-oriented can better address those changes. Consistent with this evolving client demand, I'm pleased to report that we closed the acquisition of Rare Infrastructure on October 21st, adding further strength to our investment capability in highly differentiated asset classes and strategies. So now, let's walk through the quarter. On slide two, you'll see that we recorded net income of $64.3 million for the quarter, or 58 cents per diluted share. We ended the quarter with $672 billion in AUM, a decrease quarter over quarter, driven largely by market depreciation. As I mentioned, long-term net inflows were $3.1 billion, and global distribution generated quarterly gross and net sales of $18.1 billion and $500 million, respectively. We retired 1.9 million shares for $90 million, and as I noted a minute ago, we closed the acquisition of Rare Infrastructure. Slide 3 shows our assets under management by affiliate, as well as by asset class, geography, and client type. As you can see, assets under management at our fixed income-oriented affiliates held up well, and with the exception of QS, which had a very strong flow quarter, assets under management at most of our equity affiliates declined, driven both by market depreciation and retail outflows. Slide 4 shows our affiliate overview of flows and pipeline, and the $9.4 billion pipeline of unfunded wins at quarter end reflects the resiliency of our underlying business. While our growth last fiscal year was largely driven by retail flows, growth this fiscal year has been driven more by our institutional business, again, demonstrating the diversification of our book of business. Now, as I walk you through each affiliate, I'll touch on a few highlights for each, so let's get started. Brandywine enjoyed very strong inflows during the quarter, made up of $1.3 billion in equity and $1.5 billion in fixed income flows, and leaving $4.5 billion in unfunded wins. Two takeaways. While short-term performance has been a bit challenged, Brandywine's 3-, 5-, and 10-year track records remain impressive. The flows, pipeline, and momentum at Brandywine has been quite strong, with the company having achieved its 8th straight quarter of positive net flows. Clearbridge Investments experienced $1.8 billion in outflow for the quarter, reflecting both a slowing of sales and an uptick in redemptions in retail and a rebalancing in the sub-advisory channels. Quarter-end unfunded wins were $500 million. For Clearbridge, the vast majority of outflow experienced has actually been clustered in income-type strategies. However, Clearbridge is seeing significant platform and model opportunities in their high active share and international equity suite with many of our distribution partners. Martin Currie was break-even for the quarter and closed with $500 million in unfunded wins. Highlights include investment performance broadly improved during a tough quarter, specifically in Asia active share, equity income, and European long short, and the integration and collaboration in product transition and distribution between Martin Currie and Legg Mason is at a very high level. Permal had $300 million in outflows and $300 million in unfunded wins for the quarter. Permal's highlights include performance year-to-date that is solid on a relative basis, though slightly negative in absolute terms. Recent retail adoption of Permal's products is encouraging, with $500 million in positive flows in the China AUA strategy, a slight pickup in the U.S. liquid alt strategy, and the launch of a cross-border version of the same U.S. liquid alts fund. And finally, a slowing of outflows in the European high net worth business that has persisted across the industry for some time. QS investors realized $2.8 billion in inflows for the quarter, reflecting strong interest in multi-asset products in the sub-advisory channel. There's just a lot going on right now at QS, including strong interest on the part of quasi-institutional clients in customized multi-asset class solutions. Investment performance in both developed and emerging market equity strategies at QS that is very strong, representing an important growth opportunity. And the opportunity in the retail channel to get shelf space for their products on multiple distribution platforms. An important aside, QS Investors is a critical partner for us in the continued development of next-generation products from multi-asset class solutions, managed volatility strategies, and retail liquid alternatives. QS is also the designated manager on the four ETF strategies which we filed with the SEC back in September. Royce and Associates had $2.2 billion in outflows, a modest slowing of roughly $500 million quarter over quarter. While we have acknowledged that this will be a long recovery for Royce, we believe in their investment process, the intellectual capital and leadership at Royce, and their continued commitment to high active share with high quality companies in their universe. And finally, Western Asset, with $1.9 billion in fixed income inflows and a pipeline of $3.6 billion in unfunded wins. Three key highlights for Western. Western is now on the recommended list of 90% of Tier 1 consultants, up from about 20% just a year ago. Clearly related, RFP activity is strong, trending higher than last year, and it is Western's view and ours that the longer-term money in motion opportunity is still in play. And finally, it has certainly been a challenging 15-month period for credit, especially in this past quarter, with the benchmark outperforming many managers, including Western. That said, we're encouraged by Western's performance in high-grade and broad market portfolios versus peers during this period. Slide 5 gives an overview of our recently closed acquisition of Rare Infrastructure. Rare is a very high-quality firm that has delivered attractive risk-adjusted returns over the long term. The company has a seasoned investment team and strong institutional and retail presence in a number of markets. This acquisition is the first in which we've left equity within the affiliate, thereby better aligning the long-term interests of Legg Mason shareholders with the management team at Rare. Global listed infrastructure as an investment strategy meets client demand on multiple fronts, including growth, income, and capital preservation. Now, I don't want to oversell this because, like our other acquisitions, positioning a new affiliate for retail distribution takes time. However, I'd like to share two exciting and reinforcing notes about the acquisition. First, despite the fact that we have not been able to solicit interest in Rare until we close the transaction, we've received a number of inbound calls from clients interested in learning about their capabilities and products. Post-close, we are now able to follow up with those clients and are obviously encouraged by their interest. We'll see what turns up from there. Second, we are able to immediately begin distributing Rare's existing cross-border funds to select European clients looking for income and yield. Slide 6 highlights the results from our global distribution platform, which had modest net positive sales for the quarter. Our results reflect a general pullback by retail investors amidst volatility and declines in many world equity indices and markets. Our retail market share remained steady as global outflows from active funds across the industry increased significantly. Gross sales of $18.1 billion were down 8% from the year-ago period and down 5% from the prior quarter, though, again, year-to-date gross sales on the platform remain ahead of last year. For the quarter, large sub-advisory wins that funded with QS and Brandywine Global were offset by outflows in retail. Net sales were also down from the prior quarter due to lower sales and higher redemption rates, generally in line with global industry trends. Slide 7 shows investment performance. Short-term performance in some larger fixed income portfolios was challenged through September, while equity performance improved at a number of affiliates. Long-term performance remained solid, with more than 80% of strategy AUM beating benchmarks over 3, 5, and 10 years. And with that, let me turn it over to Pete.
Thanks, Joe. I'll pick up on slide 8. Despite the industry headwinds Joe mentioned earlier, we were pleased to report our 6th straight quarter of long-term inflows. On the earnings front, we were negatively impacted by markets, which led to a $17 billion decline in average AUM. This reduced our revenues, while also negatively impacting our seed and other corporate investments, resulting in earnings of $64 million, or 58 cents per share for the quarter. At a high level, our revenue decrease was primarily driven by the decline in average long-term AUM mix and lower performance fees. In terms of expenses, the main driver of the decline in operating expenses was the drop in compensation due to lower revenues and a reduction from last quarter's higher seasonal compensation. All in, the net result was operating income that was $9 million greater than the prior quarter. As to our bottom line net income, our earnings were adversely impacted by market forces on our seed and other corporate investments not offsetting compensation, as well as the impact of a stronger U.S. dollar on an Australian dollar hedge we put in place related to the Rare acquisition. The combined impact in the quarter of these two non-operating items was $23 million, or 13 cents per share. Adjusted income was $99 million for the quarter, or 89 cents per share. This quarter's performance fees of $8 million came from Brandywine, Martin Currie, and Western. These were below our expectations as of our last call due to market headwinds, which led to decreases in absolute performance, particularly at Permal and Brandywine. While it is impossible to predict with any precision, we estimate that next quarter's performance fees could be in the range of $10 to $20 million. In terms of capital deployment, we again retired $90 million in shares during the quarter. Moving on to slide 9. The main item to highlight here is our GAAP effective tax rate for the quarter of 30.5%. This is lower than normal due largely to the finalization of open tax year audits, which resulted in the release of certain reserves. The outlook for next quarter is a return to a GAAP effective rate of approximately 36%. And as we have consistently highlighted, our actual cash tax rate continues to run at a substantially lower level than our GAAP rate. Specifically for this quarter, we were at 6%, and for the full fiscal year, we expect a cash tax rate of 5%, as you can see on page 21 in the appendix. This lower cash rate is anticipated to last at least through the end of this decade, based on our current estimates. Turning to slide 10, our ending assets under management were down 4%, despite $3.1 billion in long-term inflows. The AUM decline was driven by a combination of market depreciation, FX movements, and liquidity outflows, all of which totaled $30 billion. It is important to note this ending AUM number is now our starting point for fiscal Q3, which is 2 percentage points lower than our average AUM for the second fiscal quarter. This, along with asset class and product mix shifts, will negatively impact our advisory fee revenue next quarter. On slide 11, you can see that our long-term inflows were $3.1 billion, representing our 6th straight quarter of positive long-term flows. Fixed income inflows were $3 billion, reflecting strong demand despite market forces across a variety of our affiliates, strategies, and products. Equity flows were also a positive $100 million, thanks to custom multi-asset and dynamic allocations that offset small cap and equity income outflows. Looking ahead, our October flows should be positive based on what we know at the moment, driven in part by institutional fixed income wins at both Brandywine and Western across a variety of products. You will see on slide 10 that our total operating revenue yield, ex performance fees, declined from last quarter, primarily driven by the significant market decline in equity AUM. And here the rounding is important, as last quarter's equity was 28.4% of our average AUM versus 27.6% for this quarter. So an 80 basis point drop, but both rounding to 28%. Operating expenses on slide 13 decreased by $44 million or 8% to $540 million. I'll discuss comp and benefits on the next slide, but looking at the other line items, D&S expense decreased, reflecting the significant decline in AUM due to markets. Other expenses decreased $2 million, despite RARE-related acquisition costs and seasonal director fee expenses, as both affiliates and LM Corporate decreased their spending in the quarter. Turning to slide 14, compensation and benefits decreased by $33 million, or 10%. The primary driver behind the decline was lower compensation from revenue share affiliates due to lower revenues. Additionally, last quarter's seasonal costs of $11 million included $9 million of incremental accounting charges related to annual deferred compensation awards to retirement-eligible employees. The compensation and benefits ratio came in at 54%, in line with our 53 to 54% target for fiscal 2016. Slide 15 highlights the operating margin as adjusted, which increased from last quarter's 22.6%. Last quarter's margin was impacted by the retirement-eligible accounting charges, which reduced the margin by 1.7%. Looking forward to fiscal Q3, the operating margin will be impacted by approximately $3 million in incremental spending related to the ETF launch that Joe mentioned earlier. Moving on to slide 16, due to the significant impact of markets on our seed and other corporate investments this quarter, we provided this slide, which shows the changes from last quarter's non-operating income of $6 million to this quarter's non-operating expense of $28 million, or a $34 million swing. As I mentioned earlier, due to the stronger dollar, there was an $11 million negative mark-to-market impact on an Australian dollar hedge used to lock in the RARE purchase price. And to give you a little more color on this item, the Australian dollar recovered in October, so that when we closed the hedge earlier this month, there was a $6.6 million positive mark, which you will see in fiscal Q3. Overall, the hedge locked in an effective $20 million reduction in the RARE purchase price due to a stronger U.S. dollar since the signing of this deal. The rest of this table walks you down to the mark-to-market on seed investments, not offsetting compensation, which is a negative $13 million compared with a positive of $0.5 million last quarter. In the lower left chart, you can see the market value of our seed and deferred compensation portfolio as of September 30th. To the right, you can see the mark-to-market change embedded in the three buckets of seed investments, as well as the deferred compensation component not offset in comp expense. Slide 17 is a roll forward from fiscal Q1's GAAP earnings per share of 84 cents to this quarter's 58 cents per share. Fiscal Q1 included a tax benefit, which increased our earnings per share by 16 cents. For our fiscal second quarter, higher operating income and the impact of our share repurchases increased earnings per share by 2 cents. The change in mark-to-market on our seed and corporate investments, not offsetting comp, reduced earnings per share by 10 cents quarter over quarter. And finally, for fiscal Q2, the combination of the RARE hedge and acquisition costs, as well as the settlement of prior year tax filings, combined to reduce EPS by 2 pennies. I'll wrap up on slide 18, which highlights our quarterly cash position as well as our consistent and balanced approach to capital deployment. In the upper left, you can see that we have steadily reduced our share count by 55 million shares, or 34% since March 2010. In the upper right, we've highlighted the change in our quarterly dividend over the same time frame. We now have achieved 6 straight years of increased annual dividends, and we're particularly pleased with the magnitude of those increases since 2010, which is over 600%. In total, we've returned a very robust $2.5 billion in capital to our shareholders since we began our buyback program in 2010, a rate of capital return that is industry-leading. I should point out that this represents half of our current market cap, and we have done this while delevering to a significant degree and making a number of strategic investments in our business. On the bottom left, you can see our cash position, which was up from our seasonally low first fiscal quarter. Also, it is important to note that we used $178 million of cash in closing the Rare acquisition in October. Finally, on the bottom right, you can see the mix of our $326 million in seed investments. So thank you for your time and for your interest in Legg Mason. Now I'll turn it back to Joe.
Thanks, Pete. Our job every day is to navigate markets to the benefit of our clients and shareholders, and we remain confident in the strategic plan we have executed over the past 3 years. We believe that it is working and that it will result in long-term value for all of our key stakeholders. So before we take questions, let me leave you with what we see as the 5 key takeaways for Legg Mason from today. First, we delivered solid operating performance in a challenging market environment. Market forces certainly affected our earnings per share, but even with lower revenues, we're pleased with both our operating earnings and margins as adjusted. Next, Legg Mason continues to grow organically, and we enjoy a strong new business pipeline. This was our 6th straight quarter of long-term inflows, an organic growth rate of 2.2%. We have a strong lineup of investment affiliates in place, smart, experienced, capable people who can deliver for our clients through market cycles. Our won but not yet funded pipeline is over $9 billion, reflecting especially solid demand at Brandywine Global and Western Asset. The interest generated by QS investors, now in their 2nd year as a Legg Mason affiliate, has exceeded expectations, and we expect to translate that momentum to our DCIO sales channel over time. Across our retail platform, we see opportunities building in equity strategies at ClearBridge and Martin Currie, and alternative strategies from Permal. Finally, we believe that the Rare Infrastructure acquisition can now be another engine of differentiated growth for Legg Mason. 3, Legg Mason is well positioned for a normalized rate environment whenever that time comes. The Fed has reiterated that they expect to raise rates later this year and that it will be a gradual, data-dependent process. We are ready for that increase whenever it comes. But that's not the main event for bond markets right now. With a subdued inflation outlook and moderate growth, bond yields are likely to remain relatively low for an extended period of time. The relative performance of our fixed income platform is what matters. We have a high degree of confidence in the excellence of Brandywine Global and Western Asset Management, 2 premier fixed income managers with enviable investment track records over many market cycles. The institutional nature of our fixed income book of business, currently around 90% of the total, should also prove more resilient as rates rise. We believe that our recent institutional fixed income flows support this view. Institutional flows at Brandywine and Western were quite solid in what was a very volatile market environment. For some of our equity managers, which tend to be more quality-focused, a Fed rate hike should also benefit their performance and our clients, as a normalized rate environment should reduce correlations and create opportunities for high-quality, active managers such as Royce, Martin Curry, and Permel. From our standpoint, a normalized rate environment can't come fast enough. For strategic opportunities to diversify our business are abundant. First of all, we are very pleased with our recent acquisitions. The market for M&A is strengthening, and Legg Mason is increasingly seen as an acquirer of choice. With regard to future acquisitions, we continue to think about how to fill remaining product gaps, including energy, private equity, and real estate. We have been very active in product development, launching more than 23 new absolute return and unconstrained next generation products over the past 2 years. We are in a much stronger position to serve the varying needs of our clients and deliver for shareholders than we were only 2 years ago. We continue to ramp up product development and shelf space for QS Investors and Martin Curry. Last week, we closed the acquisition of Rare Infrastructure, whose products can help us further meet important client demands for income, capital preservation, and diversification. Rare has a long track record of success in early adopter markets such as Australia and Canada, and we believe global demand for their liquid, long-dated assets will grow in the U.S., on the continent, and in Asia, where we have strong distribution capability. And as for our much-anticipated initial ETF efforts, our legal and product teams are working with the SEC and the Street to launch an initial set of strategies soon. I look forward to updating you as that initiative progresses. And finally, we remain committed to thoughtful capital deployment. We have pledged to balance growth investments with dividends and share repurchases, and we've done that. Ultimately, our goal is to further leverage Legg Mason's global scale while continuing to diversify the business, and we're succeeding. We remain confident that our shareholders will benefit as we execute on growth, diversification, and profitability. We have more opportunity before us and more work to do. And with all that said, I am happy to take your questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. In order to allow everyone the opportunity to ask questions, we ask that you please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up. If you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. If you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. One moment, please, while we poll for questions.
Operator?
Our first question is from Chris Harris from Wells Fargo.
Thanks. Good morning, guys.
Morning, Chris.
Hey, so question on Western. Clearly another great quarter there. But I believe most of the flows are institutionally oriented. So really it seems like there's a pretty material opportunity in retail where I don't think the market share is quite where you guys like to see it, at least as it relates to Western. Can you update us on the outlook and strategy for growing Western's retail presence, particularly since the performance has been so strong? Thanks.
Sure. I agree with you, Chris, completely. So, we are pleased during the past quarter and, frankly, on an ongoing basis with what we see in terms of the institutional business for both Brandywine and Western. But with respect to both of them, you know, we saw a significant amount of industry outflow on the taxable side, roughly, I think, $45 billion or so during the quarter. Western was out, I think, $200 million, Brandywine out a bit more, maybe around $500 million, so very modest outflow there. We do believe that we are below what should be an appropriate market share for us in taxable fixed income with Western. And you're exactly right. Given the performance, we should and we do expect to pick up market share in taxables with retail as we go forward. Actually, among our, you'll notice if you look back on our slide six, Western Asset Core Plus, in terms of bond funds, has been our largest seller in terms of the retail side. So we are looking forward to growing our market share. We have seen inflows month to date in retail at Western, and we think there's just significant opportunity in retail as well as the institutional side, where our unfunded pipeline is continuing to build.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question is from Bill Katz from Citigroup.
Okay, thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. We picked up on capital management. Obviously, you've just done the RAD transaction. You highlighted the M&A is pretty good. Do I take your comments around prudent capital management to suggest that you're reaching the end of the repurchase program and might look to pick up the spending, or are you still able to sort of do it all in terms of spend and grow the business as well as look for acquisitions and buy back stock?
Now, thanks, Bill. And I kind of highlighted, again, what we've done over the last 3 or 4 years in the prepared remarks, that we've been able to return $2.5 billion of capital, and that's roughly half our market cap, over the last 5 years to shareholders and make investments. And a big reason we can do that is the tax shield and the excess cash generation that allows us. So absolutely no decline in our commitment to buying back stock and continuing to increase the dividend while we make these investments in the business.
Yeah, Bill, this is Joe. I just look at what we've done and what we've said we're going to do. And what I said, the very last thing I said before we went to Q&A is we're going to continue to balance investing in growth with dividends and share repurchase. We've said that now for the last several years. We've done that, and that's what we expect to continue doing.
Okay. And then you mentioned that flows are positive in October. I was wondering if you could possibly size that a little bit, maybe walk through institutional versus retail, and then how does that affect the pipeline on the institutional side? And maybe a related question, sorry, I slipped lighting here. Could you give us where Primal is in terms of their split of assets between high net worth Europe and the rest of the business?
Sure. So again, at a high level for October, we still have today to go and things can happen. And we always need to sort of true up across the global organization for a few days after the month ends. But I would tell you that for October, with what we're seeing right now, we've got a very solid flow month in place. Equities look to be close to break even. Fixed income looks to be strongly positive, as Pete mentioned in his remarks. Those are largely institutional fixed income wins at both Brandywine and Western. But as I mentioned, Western's positive retail as well. And then our unfunded pipe, as of the end of October, looks to be very, very strong. As for Primal, their business continues to be, they continue to be largely institutional. We did see a slight slowing in the outflow from the European high net worth business. I don't want to overstate that, but it was a nice reversal a little bit, a slowing in that trend. We're actually hoping to go after the European retail business with the launch of our liquid alternatives fund, the cross-border space. It's really a clone of the U.S. strategy we have. So we've seen outflow over the last several years from the European high net worth space. We think we can go after some of that money with our new cross-border fund there. We also had just very significant performance with Primal on the flow side out of China during the second quarter, where that strategy, which as you remember is an AUA strategy, it has fee characteristics that are attractive, but it's technically classified as AUA. We saw about, I think, $700 million in flows into that strategy. That strategy performed well from an investment performance standpoint, and we saw really nice flows. That fund now is up over $2 billion. But all of that said, Primal has continued to evolve increasingly to the institutional side of the business, but they are looking to continue building out the retail space. We've seen a small pickup in U.S. retail and Primal strategies, so that's been encouraging. Small pickup there. We're hopeful of similar pickup in Europe and then strong on the retail side with our distribution partner in China. So I think that wraps it.
And our next question is from Ken Hill from Barclays.
Oh, hey, good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Ken.
So just kind of going back to the pipeline there, it looks like QS kind of funded all the unfunded wins from last quarter but didn't have any after the $3 billion last quarter. So I think you pointed to some good momentum there in insurance sub-advisory last quarter. I know it's still very early days for that affiliate, but what are you seeing in terms of institutional demand there? And are the $2.8 billion of inflows for the quarter sustainable? So what are you doing really to onboard that fund from a distribution platform as quickly as possible?
Yeah, look, I wouldn't annualize their $2.8 billion in the quarter. I mean, that was a couple of very significant wins, which we had been calling out. That said, there's a couple of things going on. One, the interest in QS, as I mentioned, is very, very strong. This highly customized multi-asset class opportunity is really in the sweet spot of larger kind of insurance sub-advisory demand right now. They do have, I think, about in this month, 300 or so in won and funded wins. So even though they don't show up as unfunded, they actually funded in this month. But I think that was in the small cap space, which was a nice win for us because that's actually goes back to part of the legacy Battery March strategy, which is performing very, very well. You also want to remember that we have been very successful in getting QS on a number of platforms. Those don't necessarily come with takeover AUM, but they give you an opportunity for just consistent, steady flow. And I think we've gotten them on upwards of 10 different platforms over the last year. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, QS is going to be the manager for our smart beta strategies, which we hope to launch at the end of this year or early next year. So the interest and activity level at QS is extraordinarily high. And in addition, just in terms of sort of product development, QS is working actually very closely with a number of our other affiliates and looking at sort of multi-asset class active strategies where they can capitalize on Brandywine or Western Asset or ClearBridge and putting those together. So strong interest in what QS does, strong activity, strong results, I would say, and just a really good feeling about what they're doing.
And our next question is from Mike Carrier from Bank of America.
Thanks, guys. Hey, Joe, just I guess a kind of a combination question on both the flow outlook and then the fee rate. And I know this quarter, there was a lot of weird things going on, in the market that would impact it. And the pipeline looks healthy. But when I look at the short-term performance, there's some pockets, that are underperforming a bit, and I think we see that across the industry. But on the flip side, you mentioned QS, obviously Western and Brandywine, the pipelines are good, so there's a lot of demand, for the product that you guys are offering. But just want to, try to understand, sort of the institutional, like outlook versus the retail, and then from a product standpoint, what that means for both flows and mix, because it does feel like the short-term performance could have some impact versus the, strategically how you're positioned for products that are in demand.
Yeah, so Mike, the way I think about it, I'll let Pete maybe try to take a wag on the fee rate a little bit, but the way I think about it is that, you're right. I mean, we've seen some choppiness in performance in the last few months and couple of quarters, but if you look really at the 3-year, 5-year, which is where most clients really look, overall the performance across the platform remains very, very strong. We know that, Royce has been challenged, but aside from Royce, our equity and fixed income performance is just really strong. We saw meaningful improvement, I would say, overall in our equity strategies towards the end of the last quarter. We saw improvement at Royce, actually. We saw improvement at ClearBridge with appreciation and large cap value. Brandywine, their diversified large cap value strategy, we saw nice improvement in performance there. Martin Currie had a significant improvement in 1-year performance, predominantly out of their European and China strategies. And then QS, their strategies, particularly the legacy developed market strategies, are just performing at a very, very high level. I think, again, if you look at the 3, 5s, and 10s for Western, they're north of 80% of strategies beating, beating their benchmark. So, we feel good about the longer term 3, 5, 10 year. We've had some choppiness and up and down in the short term, but clients tend to look through that a little bit, which is why you're continuing to see fundings. Now, in terms of the unfunded wins, at Brandywine, for example, you're seeing unfunded wins largely in opportunistic fixed income and corporate debt. And then in large cap equity. at Western. It's really corporate debt, high yield, more broad, and then broader market strategies. And then, but on the equity side, some of the unfunded wins, both ClearBridge and Martin Currie, have ended the quarter with unfunded wins around the $500 million area. In the case of Martin Currie, that was really around regional equity and emerging market equity. And ClearBridge, their unfundeds really were around aggressive growth and equity income. Pete, do you want to maybe talk to Mike a little bit about how you see the fee rate from all of that soup that I just put together?
Sure, Joe. So, Mike, really good question. Obviously, we had a heavy impact in the quarter from the drop in equity markets, and obviously severely impacted not just us but everybody else's portfolios. And equity assets tend to be, you know, returning a bit more than fixed, clearly a lot more than liquidity. But we've recovered probably half of that due to the market rebound in October. And then when you look at the underlying trends, particularly in our fixed income business, there's really a trade going on between lower fee outflows and higher fee inflows from specialized products that's really becoming much more pronounced. The other thing that's going on, you asked a bit about retail institutional. Our global distribution business has actually had 8 straight quarters of inflows. And again, that tends to be higher fees. So the underlying trends are pretty positive overall, despite the blip that was caused by the market this last month.
And our next question is from Dan Fannon from Jefferies.
Thanks. excuse me. I guess wanted to discuss some of the disclosures you gave around Western, in particular with the consultants, the 90% number of Tier 1 consultants now recommending them. I guess, yeah, I know the bulk of their business is institutional, but is there a way to think about the percentage of AUM that kind of comes through the consultant channel, you know, just in total, or a way to kind of help think about what that might mean in terms of rate of change going forward?
So, good morning, Dan. We need to be a little bit careful because a lot of the consultants are a little bit ouchy about what you exactly say, but the fact of the matter is that, as I said, there has been a significant uptake in Western getting on recommended lists or having recommended strategies at virtually, well, at 90% of the largest consultants out there. And as I said in the prepared remarks, that's up really from 20%, I think, 14 months ago. So you've seen a significant turnaround there. Now, obviously, consultants have a significant and huge influence over institutional flows, and we're seeing that play right into the level of activity, the RFP activity at Western, which is running reasonably ahead of last year, which is good. And then I mentioned, you know, on the one of my comments that Western believes, and we do as well, that this sort of money in motion opportunity continues to be real. It's going to take time, and I can't, you know, we're not really pulling it out anymore, but we are seeing RFP activity, and in some cases, simply we've actually seen some modest takeovers without even RFPs that are really directly tied to sort of money in motion. So with all that's going on, and if you look at investment performance, Western vis-a-vis, you know, certain other managers, I would say that investment performance in conjunction with an over-concentration leaves this money in motion concept still in play. So we feel pretty good about Western's activity. The level of activity, RFPs, et cetera, at Western is the highest it's been in several years, and we just feel very good about it.
Dan, also, we might mention, individual client behavior is kind of interesting as well. They just had a big win at a client that hasn't been investing with them since before the crisis, but was a $10 billion client before the crisis, a large sovereign wealth fund, and they've just come back to Western for the first time since their performance turned around. So I think a lot of the trends Joe's talking about are pretty pervasive to their business.
And our next question is from Robert Lee from KBW.
Thanks. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Rob.
I guess I'll try to get my in looking at Arare, just kind of curious, you know, pre-closing, can you give us a sense of what their new business trends were like and, you know, maybe as we think about kind of folding it into our forecast? And then I guess also you had called out $3 million of incremental, I guess, ETF launch costs, but it also seemed like maybe there were some incremental deal costs around the transaction last quarter? Should we be thinking that they kind of offset each other, or how should we think of that?
So I'll just speak to sort of business at Rare, and then I'll let Pete talk to some of the numbers. I just actually spent some time with Nick Langley, co-CEO from Rare, earlier in the week, and we talked about, you know, sort of their activity level, and he was recounting for me the number of different institutional clients globally that they're engaged with talking about opportunities. You know, the infrastructure, the interest in infrastructure is increasing. Rare has a unique value proposition in that it is listed infrastructure, so many large institutional clients like to kind of set it or place it side by side with their unlisted infrastructure exposure. So it's we see their opportunity to grow institutionally pretty significant in the years ahead. The retail space, as I mentioned, they've long had a dominant position both in Australia and Canada. And, you know, we do see an opportunity, a significant opportunity, frankly, in the U.S., in Europe, and in Asia. One of the good things is that we currently, you know, even though we just closed last week, because they have a cross-border fund in place, we can actually get out and start marketing that now. And we've actually had a fairly significant amount of inquiry, incoming calls from clients about Rare because of the unique nature of it, you know, the high yielding nature of it, the long dated, in many cases, inflation sort of protected, even though nobody thinks about inflation today. There are those that are kind of anticipating someday inflation and the inflation adjusting nature of a lot of the products in which they invest. So we just think there is tremendous enthusiasm internally, but also among clients about the potential to extend Rare's capabilities into the retail space and their continued expansion on the institutional side. Pete, I'll let you talk about some of the items.
Yeah, sure, Rob. You know, a lot going on in the quarter, but you know, most of it's relatively small. The deal cost last quarter roughly $1 million. We'll probably have another $1 million or so relative to Rare hitting in October. And again, you know, those are one-time costs. On the ETF front, relatively modest amount to get these launched. We're talking about four products, keep in mind, and then we've got some more in the pipeline after that. But roughly $3 million is kind of what we're anticipating for the quarter. Say less than half of that will be, you know, kind of run rate kind of things going forward. So there'll be a little over half that are truly one-time costs. And then Rare will be, you know, marginally accretive, but pretty much going to offset a good bit of those incremental costs with earnings from Rare in the quarter. And obviously, we expect that business to build, given their performance, given the high demand in that product area. We'd expect their earnings to ramp up pretty nicely for us as we go forward, and particularly once we get it hooked into global distribution.
And our next question is from Craig Siegenhaler from Credit Suisse.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning, Craig.
So I just wanted to dig a little deeper on Western here. You know, I think many sort of stereotype them as a more of a credit manager. And the U.S. has been in a very good credit cycle where credit spreads have narrowed for about 6 years here. So I'm just wondering, you know, one could argue that a lot of their good performance is the result of a positive macro backdrop. So if spreads were to widen over the next couple of years here, is there reason to think their overall relative performance would hold up better this time?
So two answers or two points here for you, Craig, and I want to respectfully disagree on the first one. I would tell you that we've actually been in a bear market for credit over the last 15 months or so. And if you go back and look at where credit spreads actually were at their narrow, it would have been in the spring of 2014. And since that time, we've seen credit spreads widen fairly dramatically. And we saw that again during, you know, this past quarter. We saw spreads widen. If you look out on the long end, they've blown out dramatically. And so I think it's Western's view, and I think it's a very powerful argument, that when you look at where credit spreads are vis-a-vis where anticipated or implied default rates are, spreads are actually very attractive and very cheap in here. And so we would argue that there's less likelihood of spreads widening significantly from here. And if anything, I would argue, I don't want to speak for Western because I'm not the CIO, but I would argue that if the economy strengthens at all, there's room given the fact we've been in a bear market for credit over the last 15 months or so, I would argue there's actually an opportunity for credit spreads to tighten. But the other part of your question I think is very, very important. You know, I think in the past, Western being a heavily credit-oriented manager, during periods like we experienced during this past quarter where spreads got very choppy and widened out, I think the general consensus, the historical perspective on Western would have been, gosh, they're just going to grossly underperform. And the reality is, in this past quarter, the benchmark actually outperformed most active managers in fixed. Western's investment performance versus peers was very, very good. And so I think what they've done over the last few years, and we've talked about it, but, you know, you can talk about it all you want. The proof is in the pudding. If you look at significant events where credit spreads have widened and where historically you would have expected Western to underperform, in fact, they've actually performed quite well, either, you know, sort of in line with the rest of the market or with respect to this past quarter, even though down versus the bench versus peers, a very, very good performance. And I think that's part of what you're seeing with the consultants coming around and with the institutions coming around. They are now believing that Western has addressed sort of that high volatility component or a good part of that high volatility component to with respect to how they manage money.
And our next question is from Eric Berg from RBC Capital Markets.
Thanks much. Can you hear me?
We can. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. Thanks very much, Joe. Good morning to you and everyone in Baltimore. I think I heard you say that there were some of the outflows in the quarter were related to dividend-oriented products. And I was surprised to hear that, if I heard you correctly, just because there's been such a multi-year emphasis, especially by retail investors, on dividend and other income-paying products. So my question is really twofold, and the two parts to it, and I think the parts are probably related. One, why the, if I have your comments correct, why the sudden drop in interest in income-oriented products? And relatedly, could you contrast Brandywine and ClearBridge to help us better understand why one was in outflow mode and the other in inflow mode?
So a couple of things, Eric. I wouldn't read too much into the fact that at ClearBridge the outflows were largely related to income strategies. I think there's a couple of things going on there. I think one was a significant reallocation on the part of one sub-advisory client, and that's a tactical decision, a rebalancing or reallocation that client made for whatever reason they made it. We continue to manage a fairly significant amount for them, so I wouldn't read too much into it. That's, you know, we get rebalancings. We talk about this in fixed income. You know, we get rebalancings at times in fixed income, and that comes out of equity, and it goes back and forth. So I wouldn't read too much out of that. We saw certain retail products that weren't performing as well on the income side. We saw a significant slowdown in flows and a slight uptick in outflows there. But I wouldn't read too much into it. And I would suggest to you that actually we've seen that reverse a little bit in October, where we're seeing interest again in those income strategies, certainly in the retail space at ClearBridge. As it relates to the compare and contrast from ClearBridge and Brandywine, the way I think about it is this. ClearBridge has had some significant, kind of headline products or franchise type products where flows slowed a little bit and actually sales slowed a little bit. Redemptions in those products really didn't significantly increase. It's just the sales did. And I attribute that largely to the market environment. I mean, it was just a pretty darn tough market environment for advisors to be getting retail investors into the market. So we saw, and there was a little bit of performance there, I would say, but we saw a significant slowdown in some of those franchise products at ClearBridge. And even without a significant uptick in outflows, that just takes your net flows out. I would say Brandywine's a different story. We've never really marketed Brandywine in the field on the equity side. We've obviously done a lot of that on the fixed income side, but it's not really ever been on the retail equity side. A lot of the flows you're seeing, Brandywine actually has a number of equity products with really terrific performance, and our quasi-institutional and insurance sub-advisory teams have recognized that and have been successful in going after and some takeover opportunities at some of their larger clients. So that's what you're seeing there. You're seeing not so much kind of the daily flows out of retail at Brandywine, but some large quasi-institutional type takeover wins there with a large quasi-institutional outflow tactically down at Clearbridge.
And our next question is from Michael Kim from Sandler O'Neill.
Hey, good morning. Maybe just a question for Pete. Just wondering if your thinking on discretionary spending has maybe changed a bit, just given the recent step up in market volatility and the related impact on revenues. And then more specifically, just to come back to sort of other operating expenses, came in lower on a sequential basis. I know you walked through some of the ins and outs looking out into this quarter, but just trying to get a sense of the outlook for that line going forward. Thanks.
Yeah, Michael, good morning, and good question. There's always a lot of need for transparency, I guess, in terms of our P&L with the revenue share model. But you know, in terms of discretionary spending, keep in mind, you know, probably two-thirds of the spending is at affiliates, where whatever they don't spend on space or travel or whatever goes into their bonus pool. But in quarters like we had last quarter, where revenues were down significantly, you know, it's kind of interesting how self-correcting our model is, because when you work through the one-off items, and we've got a roll for it on page 17 in the deck, but if you work through those one-off items, we pretty much were flat core earnings quarter over quarter at about 68 cents. So, you know, the discretionary spending that we're controlling at corporate, and then kind of the self-correcting nature of the revenue share model, really kind of showing through here. And then on other expense, historically, we've probably run more closer to $50 million per quarter. Again, probably two-thirds of that at the affiliates and a third at the parent level. I envision that kind of run rate that's going to stay down a bit for the foreseeable future until markets bring us back up from a revenue perspective. And then the things that we had at corporate, again, are really the deal costs and the ETF costs that will hit this next quarter. Does that help?
It does. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure thing.
Our next question is from Mac Sykes from Gabella.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mac.
Just two quick questions, one related. Joe, can you just provide us an update on the actions taken to increase productivity in the distribution unit? I think you've talked about big data in the past, maybe changing geographic mix, you know, people on the phones, et cetera. And then also with the announcement of the ETFs, will they be marketed eventually through this channel?
Well, the answer to the second question is yes, absolutely. And actually, we've been going through a fair amount of training internally around this, because it's a different sale and it's a different approach. And, you know, we really, our approach within our distribution platform is really around solution selling. And I know that that is a bit of a buzzword, but that's really the way we approach it. So we're now adding a capability around this ETF strategy and smart beta, which can really stand up next to, and in some cases we would argue take share from the passive space, the classic sort of market cap-weighted passive space. So that's a new capability. And then you bring in something like RARE, and that's another capability that we can bring in. So, and to provide and address solutions around the needs of our clients. Look, I'm very pleased with the work we've done within, particularly in the U.S., around adding people, training those people in our model and in our products, which takes time, and then getting them out in front of clients. We've really kind of expanded the number of delivery approaches that we have. You know, we added it's not just any more people in the field and then internal wholesalers, but we've added over the last few years a cross-channel desk and then a call center desk. So we've added different ways to kind of go out. We've segmented the advisor population, which is enormous, and then we've in the process of segmenting it, chosen how we want to address it, whether it's in the field directly, face-to-face, whether it's more of a combination of face-to-face and phone sales through our cross-channel team, whether it's really just phone touches that, you know, get us into locations where we just have very little chance of getting from a travel standpoint. I feel good about it. I'm not going to give metrics around it because those are sort of internal metrics, but I feel very good about the work that's being done and the fact that we've gotten so many of these people, you know, on the lines, talking to clients, the contacts. The one thing I will tell you is the amount of contact that we are having with advisors has grown dramatically over the past year, and that's directly related to the investments that we've made, the people that we've hired, and that contact, when done on a regular basis and relationships established in tandem with the products that we have, high-quality products with great performance, that's going to yield results. I think there's no one here that has any doubt about that.
And we have time for one final question, and it is from Michael Cyprys from Morgan Stanley.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the question. Just wanted to follow up on the RARE infrastructure, some of your earlier commentary. It sounds like there's opportunity to scale on the distribution side, but just curious how you're thinking about capacity on the product side with their focus on listed infrastructure, and then what's the appetite and opportunity, would you think, on expanding and doing more on the private infrastructure side?
Yeah, well, on the second piece, on the private infrastructure side, I mean, that would be a new business. We've actually talked to them about that. We've talked to them about, about unlisted, as you talked about, private or unlisted infrastructure. We've talked about infrastructure debt. But right now, they're, you know, and these are guys that could do that, right? Because as I mentioned when we announced the acquisition, Nick Langley and Richard Elmsley are guys that formed this company having grown up in the unlisted infrastructure space. So they understand that, and they've used that knowledge and that capability and that experience to leverage that into the listed infrastructure business. They've got a lot more runway right now in listed infrastructure. So, you know, are there opportunities for extensions into infrastructure debt or unlisted infrastructure? Sure, but I think those are down the road. I think there's a lot more runway right now with what they have. I think retail side, in terms of product, you know, I think the products that they have, where, as I mentioned, we already have a cross-border fund open that our teams in Europe can begin to sell. We're optimistic that we're going to be able to get a 40 Act fund with their kind of signature products into the U.S. in reasonably short order, but we don't always control all of that. So I think we're feeling very good about our ability to leverage them. And then I think there's just been a lot of interest from, you know, this quasi-institutional penetration that we have. Our quasi-institutional team has just obviously demonstrated how strong it is and how effective it is, particularly with QS, to a certain extent with Martin Curry, and with our legacy affiliates. I mean, we do a ton of business with our legacy affiliates. Brandywine, we've highlighted that, and Western. So we really think that's going to be a place where we ought to be able to get some pretty good traction pretty quickly, hopefully, with RARES in that quasi-institutional space. So we feel pretty good about all of the channels and all the opportunities.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everybody and those listening who joined us this morning. I hope you can tell that I'm very, very proud of the incredible work on the part of my colleagues here at Legg Mason and our affiliates. And it's all in service to our clients and to our broader stakeholders. We are pleased with our overall performance in what has certainly been a challenging environment. And yet we see so much more that we can do and we can achieve. Our ambitions at Legg Mason are high, but they're exceeded only by the opportunity before us and our determination to succeed. And I look forward to updating you on our progress again next quarter. So have a nice day.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's teleconference. Thank you for your participation, and you may now disconnect your lines at this time.